I took this incredibly difficult decision. I don't think people understand quite how difficult it is to stand up and put your name forward publicly, effectively to vote down your own government.
So you essentially, you know, for want of a better word, you rebelled against the government.
Yeah.
Right.
You've probably seen that photo of Rachel Reeves crying in the chamber. I feel bad.
Awful.
I feel bad for Rachel.
It's awful seeing anybody cry.
I just think, you know, how did we get here is an interesting question. And I think the first place we've got to start is to go backwards. So Rachel was by Keir at PMQs basically after this climb down around the welfare bill. And why did the government, you know, come about to do this cost-cutting exercise with the welfare bill? What was your understanding of what had gone on there?
Well, firstly, I thought it's so haste and it seems so rushed. And also, it's a huge climb down from where it once was before. My guess is that, I mean, to meet the kind of OBR fiscal rules and the kind of economic targets that have been set for it, largely from herself, this was a necessary step that they felt they had to do ahead of the autumn statement.
So the welfare budget is ballooning, right? It's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. It's projected to almost double, I think, over the course of this parliament. It's already increased at a massive rate since COVID. We're an outlier in this regard. We've got more people out of work than any other like European nation that you would...
One in six people of our age or so
are... Yeah, are claiming PIP at the moment.
Yeah.
And one of the big bursts in this has come from people our age actually claiming around mental health incapacity, right? So like if you've got anxiety, depression, etc., and then you can claim benefits. Now, PIP's not just an out of work benefit. So like people can be in work and claiming, which is worth bearing in mind, but it's about 16% who are in work. So 5/6 of people are not in work whilst they're claiming. And a lot of them, as we've just explained, are people of our age. Like I've had my share of mental health problems. Yeah. And
I think everyone has. Definitely.
I think there's like a deeper question about what the root causes of like why our mental health is messed up. And like, I don't think it's just the fact that we're living in like, you know, post-financial crash, lack of opportunities world, AI is taking all of our jobs, global instability, this war's about to happen. We've grown up with social media. You know, I don't think it's just because of that.
Ecological crisis.
You know, I don't think it's just because of that. Like, I think there's just been a whole complete restructuring of like childhood, essentially.
But also, yeah, how we socialize with each other, how we interact with people.
Two things can be true, right? On the one hand, it can be true that our generation is really messed up and is having to deal with a really difficult hand that we've been dealt, and that it's understandable in those circumstances why people have mental health problems. But it can also be true that like just giving like handouts essentially is no way to solve solve that problem. Young people like us, you know, the reason we're happy as people and like happy, quote unquote, like I feel very stressed by this job all the time, but I have a sense of purpose every day,
exactly.
Right? Like we've taken agency over our lives by choosing this career. You know, I remember, and I imagine it was the same for you, that once we got our degrees, we were in a situation where you kind of could have chosen to do what you wanted to do. And there was a choice like, do I want to go and take loads of money and like make loads of, and like take care of my family? Or do I want to do something which has like an impact? And we both chose this option because it's
an interesting life because we had a level of agency that so many people sadly don't have, because a bit like what we were saying earlier, work is disempowering largely, or they're so concentrated within the metropole. In this country, it's all concentrated in London. A lot of young people are flocking to London. There's competition for housing and kind of all of these types of things. There is such a lack of purpose amongst the generation of people for whom purpose has been stripped.
Yeah.
We were sentenced to our houses for almost 2 years during COVID. So any form of kind of opportunity that would have naturally developed for many people as a consequence of maybe finishing uni or coming of age or all these things, completely dissipated, and the world is still kind of patch itself up.
Yeah.
What does the world look like in this?
But I just think that one of the problems is we are consumers, not citizens, and our generation is the worst for it. Like we've grown up with so much relative privilege, you know, like I'm born in 2000, you're 97 baby, like We've grown 96. Up with so
96.
96.
Yeah. You're washed, bro.
No.
Bro. You know what I mean? Like, we've just grown up with these load of relative privileges that have made us really good at, like, in sense of having a sense of entitlement to the world around us, and like, and easy, like an easy answer to things. Mm. Dopamine rushes. And it's
all instantaneous based, as well.
Exactly. Everything is path of least resistance. And I think that is shortchanging us, actually, mm-hmm. becoming people. And we need to become citizens again, not just consumers. And that's why I hope people who listen to this show take this as an invocation to go and do something that is for their community. Like, do something that
but
is
also
for
something that is for themselves as well, that gives
that
them
is
a
for
sense
yourself.
Of actualization. Yeah. I mean, I think that's what it is obviously for your community. I think that goes without saying. But what gives you a sense of purpose and drive, and that you can sleep at night quite easily thinking, I've applied myself 100% today? And I think that's how you become a more nourished and enriched society, because you can lean on the kind of merits and expertise of everybody who's gone into the arts, who've gone into engineering, who's gone into politics, who's gone into literature, a whole range of brilliant and wonderful things that kind of our species collectively over 200,000 years have been able to achieve. And we've reached this like cliff edge where that kind of creativity to a point has been stifled because we're kind of burdened by this long arm of consumption, like you're saying. There's no responsibility to ourselves and others.
Exactly. There's no responsibility anymore. There's no sense of what do I owe my neighbor, you mm-hmm. know, like, and I just think that this is the world you live in. Like, this is the bed that we've made and we have to sleep in.
But I don't think we have to sleep in it. I think there is an obligation. Yeah, yeah. Remake the bed.
Yeah, yeah. Remake the bed.
Wash the sheets and remake the bed.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Wash them dirty sheets before you. Do you know what I mean? Like, you know, uni, you know, like second time of uni, yeah. When, bro, like 8 weeks for go by and it's like these yellow stains on the... Oh, bro, that's what we're living right now. Yeah, man. Like, the thing is that we're basically accepting then, you know, broadly, Rachel Reeves's idea that the welfare budget did need to change. Like, that we need reform of the welfare system. And I think the thing that we're lacking...
we need a reimagination of it.
Exactly. You need a project, a political project in which you ally these welfare reforms. The way in which she tried to communicate it, and I think that there's an explanation for this that does make a lot of sense, is that she wanted to make it clear that we were cutting money, that we were sensible. And what we're trying to signal there was that there is a problem here. Some people are also cheating the system. That's definitely going on. And you're a liar if you ignore that to be the case. But... you know, you had to signal to the wider economic constraints that we live under, these strong fiscal rules. So this is like Rachel Reeves's like ability to borrow money and to spend it, essentially. Now, she's put herself under quite tight constraints because of Liz Truss, essentially, because we messed up the whole bond market by giving this massive idea about how to spend, give all these tax cuts without them being funded. And she's... we've
Some
had to
people
pick
would
up,
argue a different...
Well, go on.
No. I mean... My view is, as much as I think that is true, I think there's also a kind of bureaucratic nebulous in this country that restricts like a sovereign parliament from taking and making decisions that elected politicians have stood on a platform and are there to do. And so in an attempt to kind of save the bureaucratic institutions of the country, they are... much more haste to kind of bring them down and suggest that it was illogical or kind of a political program that just wasn't suited to the times it was in. And I'm not saying this is not an excuse for the very real realities and consequences of what Liz Truss did, but I think there are kind of more systemic problems around how institutions and bureaucracies interact and engage with democratic states.
And just to be really clear for listeners who aren't fully clued up on this stuff, because it is really complicated and I've only really wrapped my head around it recently. Essentially, we borrow money to pay for stuff, mm-hmm. right? And our government runs off debt, right? And we have a huge debt puzzle. It's about $1 trillion at the moment, where we keep on spending more
guilt.
So you have bonds, right? Yeah. Which is about how much the government sells.
Trading.
Yeah, so the government debts, sells bonds. And we have to refinance debt. And so the problem is that if you keep on selling more bonds and people think that they're not worth much, the percentage that you have to pay on your debt to refinance it goes
increases,
up. So this is the puzzle that Rachel Reeves is trying to solve, right? It's like, why can't we borrow loads of money to spend loads of money? Because we're then going to have to pay for it at some point. And what's the plan? Mm-hmm. And so...
Well, it's inflationary at that point.
This is the same problem that the US is going through right now. And Donald Trump has just done these massive, massive, massive tax cuts in this big, beautiful bill, which is going to increase US debt, right? So this kind of speaks to your point a little bit more, which is that there seems to be no brakes on this debt machine. And every major economist would say that at some point, the markets will rebuke you.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know. I am not an economist by any stretch of the imagination. I probably butchered that explanation, but
we will have to get an economist.
I'm appreciating that there is something really difficult that we're trying to make sense of here, and that there has to be some sort of solution to this. You've got these right-wing economists, who I think, who just say, you know, well, this is just the way the world works. Mm-hmm. You know, suck it up. What? I just don't think that the rest of the public will buy that.
Well, what's the phrase? It's easier to imagine the end of the world before it is to imagine the end of capitalism. And that's exactly where we're at. That's the problem.
Okay, so we've got an MP coming in to actually, you know, sit and talk to us about this, which is, I think, an incredible...
Hopefully not the end of the world.
Hopefully not the end of the world in the circumstances. But yeah, look, let's doomerism, man. Like, let's try and figure out some form of positivity we can take forward. Like, there has to be a vision for a world that we want to live in, because I'd much rather live in something than nothing. Here we are today with our first ever MP in the hot seat.
Oh, wow, there we go.
Henry Tufnell of Mid and South Pembrokeshire. Yeah. Big ups. Welcome, Henry. How are you feeling? It's been a pretty manic 24 hours.
Yeah, no, thanks very much for having me. It's great to be the first Labour MP, or first Labour MP on your podcast.
Yeah, great. Maybe the last as well, after, depending on how this goes. Didn't someone text you on the way here saying, you know, like, are you sure you want to go on a podcast the last 24 hours?
That has happened.
I mean, firstly, how have you been just in the last day or so, given how much of a whirlwind the whole thing is?
Yeah, it's been difficult, but I think that it's often sort of a building process. So there was this obviously one moment where we signed the Reason Amendment that came out on Monday last week, and then there was a subsequent event that happened thereafter. But before that, there was lots of engagement with ministers, with the Secretary of State, feeding into other members. So there was conversations happening between colleagues over many months before.
Do you want to just quickly talk us through the Reason Amendment and what it actually was and designed to do?
And in plain English, because what even is a reason?
Yeah, so essentially it's just a mechanism by which you kill the bill, right? Really. And so we've got a majority of, 165? So if you have 83 people vote against it, then the bill dies.
Right.
And then the government, then that's it. So they have to bring it back in the next parliamentary session.
So you essentially, you know, for want of a better word, you rebelled against the government.
Yeah.
Right. One of the things that I'm trying to make sense of is how we got to a position where this had to happen. And I think loads of other people are quite confused about what the messaging should or could have been. Mm. And it sounds like you have a bit of a different position to some of the other people who've rebelled, who said that it was just a matter of the government being completely out of touch. You actually do believe in some of the measures that are proposed.
Yeah. Yeah, we have a real crisis in Pembrokeshire. Like 20% of the working age population in Pembrokeshire are on universal credit. We've had big crisis in mental health as well. So the in terms of PIP claimants, so personal independence payments, 16 to 19 year olds, there's been a massive increase in that age group claiming.
And that's been since COVID, would you say?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Claiming PIP. And so those are big structural issues that we have in my community in Pembrokeshire. And, you know, fundamentally, a massive welfare bill is a symptom of
a deeper malaise within
society. You know, we've got problems with healthcare, with public transport, and the main big thing we've got problem is with jobs, right? We don't have enough good, well-paid jobs locally that people can stay in the county and have a good, secure life.
Right. So what the bill was missing for you was a clear and obvious plan about how you were going to get from people who are claiming to actually into work.
Yes. So in terms of the support measures.
Right.
But then also, you know, these are... inherently sort of more vulnerable people in society. And I'm not prepared as a Labour MP to effectively walk them off a cliff in a cost-cutting exercise. This has to be a clear pathway in which they can be supported back into work. And that was something that I felt incredibly, passionate about. And that's why I took this incredibly difficult decision. I don't think people understand quite how difficult it is to stand up and put your name forward publicly, effectively to vote down your own government. You know, I have immense respect for the Prime Minister. You know, he's one of the reasons why I'm an MP. He comes from that legal legacy. He spent a lot of time, you know, working as a human rights barrister, as the director of public prosecutions. I worked as a barrister as well. So, you know, I believe in the Prime Minister. I think he's, you know, and I think he's shown excellent leadership. You know, he's listened, he's engaged, and he's made a major change.
So what should he make of the U-turns then?
Well, so everyone goes on and on about the U-turns, but actually I think it's a mark of leadership that you're prepared to listen, engage, accept that you need to change course, and then make those changes, make those concessions. And I view that as a positive. Yeah. I don't think it's you can't have a government that is, you know, without the ability to be flexible, without the ability to change course correct.
Yeah.
We need to have those qualities in our leadership.
Yeah. It's salvageable, isn't it? I mean, I know it's like the media's going absolutely berserk and saying that this is it, but I think this is that we still can work together to figure something out here.
Yeah, for sure. Totally. And I think this is all about that the other bit that's being missed, and we sort of touched upon it, is that there's a wider issue about all the things that we talked about during the election campaign, about the NHS, about jobs, about housing, about public transport, like all of those things.
Infrastructure.
Yeah. It interact with why you have a very large, you know, welfare.
Exactly. And I guess that was the kind of crux of the problem, I suppose, was the fact that the state is just ballooning and accommodating people that we really can't, at a point, begin to afford to accommodate. I mean, by standards, I think in the next 10 years or so, it's going to have doubled the amount of people that are going to be in receipt of some of these benefits. And the state, as we know, after the back of 14 years of the Tories, can't really accommodate it. But what do you do? I mean, if this isn't the answer that Labour MPs want, what does the solution kind of look like?
Well, there are like major reforms that are going to be taking place. So like the right to try, like allowing people the opportunity to try to work without the threat of their benefits being removed, scrapping like work capability assessment. Like these things are big, sizable movements in the welfare system, and having an emphasis on the job centres. Having, you know, in Pembrokeshire, we have a problem that a lot of the third sector organisations and businesses talk about, you know, they need to have better engagement with job centres. We need to try and get that relationship working in order that people can feel like they can try, they can move into work and be supported in that working environment. I was having a call with a constituent earlier this week who was talking about how they'd been discriminated against, disabled, being discriminated against at work, and then had no, you know, there was an inability to have access to justice, right? Because we have a big problem, we have a legal desert. You know, all these other issues feed into this wider problem. It can't be, and we'd be slightly become obsessed with focusing on the numbers, on the welfare bill, on the all, but actually you've got to take a step back, and this is part of what, you know, Labour was elected to do, which is put forward an agenda of radical change in this country. And that was our slogan, change. And, you know, the Prime Minister has a plan for change, and we're moving at speed in order to try and do that. My issue was about the sequencing, that you have to have these reforms to be enacted, to take effect, to have an effect on society before you take away, or before you move away from that benefit system.
Yeah, but that,
and I have to, and now we have 2 years, right, before these reforms will start, in order for these changes to take effect, before these reforms to take effect on the NHS, on, you know, do you talk about infrastructure in terms of that level of investment from the spending review?
Yeah, I take your point. There's such a broad range of problems that we're trying to figure out right now, and there's never going to be a one size fits all answer. But that doesn't also mean we can neglect that in the minutiae of some of these problems, there are some massive issues, like you touched upon there, the 16 to 29 year olds, that being a massive increase in the welfare bill on PIP claimants in particular around mental health. And like, speaking of someone of our generation, we do all have mental health problems. Like, we are mentally really messed up, and I've dealt with my fair share of stuff with depression and anxiety, and I still, you know, have to manage that sort of stuff. You know, my personal experience was that actually getting into work and having a purpose and a job and a structure and a social life around that was really helpful for me, especially when I was like really struggling. And you just don't often, like, it's kind of a Tory argument to kind of make that claim that, like, you know, work is empowering. But we are the Labour Party. Do you know what I mean? Like, we are the party of work. And for some reason, I think we found ourselves in this place now where it's like, you know, we're much happier to tell people, well, you know, in some cases, you know, there are people who are taking the piss out of the system and are abusing it. And we're not helping them by not getting them back into some sort of structure or purpose.
Yeah, I think the issue with work, though, is like, what type of work are you talking about? You're talking about good, well-paid jobs.
Yes,
or you're talking about insecure,
low-paid
work.
Yeah, working in an Amazon factory where you can't piss in a bottle or whatever.
Yeah, or, you know, or you're on a 0 hours contract, you're going to be, you know, there's a hire and refire, all these things that we had in our employment rights bill that we looked to, you know, try and reform. And I worked for a small trade union called the Cleaners and Allied Independent Workers Union, and we were helping campaign for cleaners to get better pay and working conditions. And some of the things that I saw down there in terms of on that sort of grassroots level, completely shocking, like employers just taking the piss and doing things that they shouldn't be doing, and then banking on the fact that because there was a cultural gap sometimes, or because people didn't understand how to enforce their rights, there was no repercussions for effectively breaking the law.
One of the things that's been overlooked, I think, as part of the conversation broadly, is that a lot of these are in-work benefits that are also being cut for people who are literally doing all the things that we're asking them to do more. And I think, to me, the kind of greatest sin of the whole thing was the fact that disabled people's organisations were not consulted or not engaged. And they've talked about the Timms Review, which I think is now a welcome addition that is coming before the new bit of legislation. But what do you make of that? The fact that a whole demographic of people who this bill is designed to, well, who it's going to affect, have been largely excluded from the creation of the legislation?
Well, that was why the concessions were so important. So that, you know, that we had the Timms Review, that was part of one of those concessions that were made by government, that you have that co-production with disability rights groups. So, you know, that was one of the reasons why me and other colleagues changed our position and came on that journey to end up supporting the bill.
How much do you think, I'm curious about the kind of politics of this all. So how do you kind of make a judgment to basically kill the bill against what's happening in your constituency, your own kind of political judgment, pressure from kind of the whips and kind of conversations that have been ongoing for weeks and months behind the scenes? How do you kind of come to that conclusion? What is the kind of political kind of operation in your head to make this judgment?
So I've always been really clear that I'm there to represent the people of Pembrokeshire. Like, I put Pembrokeshire first, and that's incredibly important in terms of my relationship with my constituents. So I'm prepared to take these difficult decisions, and they are very, very difficult decisions because there is enormous pressure being exerted on you from inside the party. But I'm prepared to do that because I believe that I'm there to represent them, and that means making these tough decisions.
So would you take a decision that you thought was in, like, the interest of your constituents if it meant that actually it was bad for your career? Like, it was bad, like, you might lose your seat.
Yeah, well, I've already done that, right? I've put my name to an amendment. You know, that's not helpful for my political career. I spoke up about the farming issue last year. That's not helpful for my political career. But I'm doing that because I've got a huge amounts of farmers, you know, family farms in my constituency. I've got a lot of people that rely, vulnerable people that rely on these benefits. And if they need to see a route out for them, they can't just be walked off a cliff.
Yeah.
And so these are incredibly important issues, and I'm prepared to stick my head above the parapet in order to defend the rights and, you know, interests of my constituents.
Yeah. I mean, I appreciate everything that you've laid out there. And I think if all of our MPs worked in the sense of, like, putting country before party, like we promised to, then we would actually be in a bit of a better position. And there's just, like, dishonesty at the heart of politics. And I don't know, we're focusing inwardly on, like, what we can do, but, like, the Tories backed in the election, they were promising tax cuts, you know, at a time when
the country cannot afford.
Yeah, and the public purse is completely broken. And we had, when we did the transfer of power, people going into those, you know, new ministerial roles, finding all of these booby traps, right, that were just there. And we've got to a point, I feel, where the public are exhausted about hearing about somebody else's fault for a problem. They just want people to kind of, like, grab it by the balls and say that this is our thing to, you know, to take hold of. But that doesn't necessarily discount the fact that things are much worse and harder than we ever expected them to be, I think, when we were in opposition.
Yeah, I've had conversations with ministers talking sort of about, like, booby traps in departments. And, yeah, I get that it's frustrating from the public, but that doesn't get away from the reality of the situation that we were left with a dire inheritance. And that after 14 years of them doing that, it doesn't take a year. You know, you're not going to fix it in a year. It's a longer process, and it is going to be difficult.
An argument I've heard time and time again is the Labour Party had almost 14 years to prepare for government. And in that time, there's been austerity and all the things that we've spoken about that have, I guess, trashed the state and left so many people in such levels of destitution. What do you say, I guess, a year on now from the government being elected, where people obviously don't want to hear the excuses, but there's a sense of feeling that we did have enough time to prepare, and a year later, it seems as though we're still ironing out some of these kind of issues, first year in kind of problems. What do you kind of say to that?
Well, there has been quite a lot of, you know, stuff that we've done during this year. We, you know, look at the NHS with what we're doing on that. If you look at the Employment Rights Bill, building new houses, like all these measures that we're putting in place, you know, trying to get a grip on securing our borders, you know, all these things take time, but that there's a process that happens in order to get there. And, you know, yes, you can have time to prepare an opposition, but government is hard. And as, you know, we were just talking about, if you're coming from a position whereby, you know, you thought you might be there, and actually because of the actions of the previous government, you're way below that, and you're having to get up, you know, that's difficult, and that takes time. And I get that it's frustrating for the public. Like we're frustrated by it, and we want to go quicker. We want to be, you know, we want things to get better for the average people in terms of increasing the money in their pockets and making them feel like public services work for them again. But with all these things, it requires time and patience.
Yeah. And I think going back to your point earlier about, you know, good jobs, there's a wider point to be made here about the way our economies are set up, right? Like we have the gig economy in this country is massive, and they're jobs that, you know, aren't empowering really. I mean, like if you've spoken to anyone who works as like a delivery driver, it's really hard. Often those jobs aren't unionized, very much like a sense of restricted camaraderie, like with your fellow worker, they're very isolating. And then you have to start kind of zoom out and think, well, how have we set up our country and our citizens to flourish? Like have we set them up in a place where they can? I know you're doing a lot of stuff around, is it floating offshore wind, is that right? Yeah, so in your constituency you're trying to do stuff around getting, you know, GB Energy to work and provide jobs for people in those places. And that's something I'm really interested in, because it feels as if like the reshoring of like industrialized work is going to be like completely essential to diffusing the populist problem, right? Populism thrives off the fact that these communities have been left behind. I mean, how do you feel about the way that stuff is shaping up? Are you feeling positive about it?
Yeah, it's really exciting. So it's an opportunity to floating offshore, to get, sort of give a bit of context. 20% of the UK's energy comes to the port of Milford Haven, which is in my constituency. We have an oil refinery, two LNG, so liquefied natural gas, and a gas-fired power station. We used to have, back in the sort of heydays, 60s, 70s, there were sort of four oil refineries, and we're now down to one.
Right. So that's a loss of a ton of jobs then, really.
Yeah, so Valero, which is the main oil refinery, has 500 jobs directly, and then a sort of 500 indirect. So there's about 1,000 jobs in the community, and these are well-paid jobs, so 40, 50, 60, 70K.
Oh, wow.
And so, you know, to lose that would be devastating. We've only got nearly 30% child poverty in Pembrokeshire. So if you had, if you lost those jobs, it would be.
And are those jobs local jobs? Are those going to local people, or people coming from other parts?
Yeah. So some of them will be local, and then there will be an occasion that, you know, I think when they have a shutdown, for instance, I think they, you know, in terms of the level of, manpower that's required, it means that inevitably people come in from outside. And there's been a sort of dearth in welders, for example. So we've had to, you know, you've had to sort of look to source jobs from elsewhere. But ideally, that's why we've had such an emphasis on skills. We've got Pembrokeshire College, which does a lot of work. We had investment from Shell, in £1 million investment into trying to improve facilities for students there, so that we can get sort of apprenticeships, that vocational work back in. So that's so important. And again, comes back to in terms of giving young people an opportunity to stay in the county. And that's why this transition has to be a just transition. That's so important. but to have the opportunity of renewable energy and these new jobs come in. And there are similarities with in terms of the skills that you have in fossil fuels, and then you can go into floating offshore wind, for example. So if you're looking at the fabrication of the substructures, so they sit in the water and they float with chains and anchors down there. So if you're making those parts, there's inevitable crossover with the oil and gas sector.
Yeah, I mean, but then you're landing on an interesting point here, which is that obviously we need to pursue net zero. Obviously there's going to be opportunities there, but also, you know, we can't just like leave behind people who work in the oil and gas sector. Exactly. And it brings me back to like our thing, which is like we're kind of internationalists, like Javan and I. We feel like the only way you solve these like global problems is through like global cooperation, basically. And it doesn't seem to me to make any sense that whilst that's quite a remote possibility of happening right now with Trump in America and, you know, things shaping up with the populist right more globally and an unstable world, that we're going to be able to exercise, you know, those rules. But we have to make sure that we take care of these jobs in the meantime. Like, we can't just end, you know, all oil and gas ideologically, right?
So, like I said, we had four oil refineries, right? If you lose one of those oil refineries because of the way in which you're set up, and they, you know, take down that refinery, ship it over to a country like Pakistan,
yeah,
and put it up there, and then you're emitting probably actually more carbon, yeah, because, yeah, of the restrictions in that country. The only people that lose out are the people in my constituency.
Yeah.
Like, you're still emitting the same level of carbon into the atmosphere. Like, the refinery is still taking place. Yeah. It's a loss to my community, and it's a devastating loss to my community.
Yeah, I think the scrap steel stuff that happened was a big mistake, to be honest with you. Now, in hindsight, I understand why we did it in pursuit of the net zero goals. I'm pro net zero. I just think you can't be an isolated island, you know, trying to pursue it on your own with no support. Like, we need people to have, like, we need a just energy transition, right? It's not going to happen overnight, and you don't do it by clicking your fingers. It takes time, and it requires cooperation and people in work.
But you also need domestic security and sovereignty of your own kind of resources and labor force. And so in all of that, it's not just about, quite rightly, the transition to something much more environmentally friendly. It's about what is good for this country. And I think sometimes you lose sight of, in pursuing like a kind of almost ideological ecology, you lose sight of the actual interests of people who are just going to work, making ends meet ordinarily. And I think at times that can be lost by government and ministers and people around kind of politics.
It's going to take time for a lot of the renewable stuff to come online, particularly if you look at my constituency in Pembrokeshire with what we've got with the Celtic Sea. This is going to take sort of 2030s, right, to really come online. And there's a pipeline of, in terms of, we just leased 4.5 gigawatts, and there'll be further 12 to come on. So that's a sort of pipeline there, which is really good. But in that, there's going to be a gap, right, in terms of that time frame between those coming online, those jobs happening, and you've got to protect those existing industries and allow them a pathway to flourish in the context of decarbonisation and hitting these goals. Mm-hmm. Like, you can't just have a draconian attitude to this and just cut them off, because it's devastating for local communities. And ultimately, you will lose the argument around net zero if you push these people into unemployment and destitution.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that's the difference between us and the Greens, I think, is that, like, often what the Greens say, I'm like, in principle, like, ideologically, like, I understand where you're coming from, but, like, practically, we can't do that yet. And I guess this is the big thing why short-termism comes in, right, which is, like, as you say, it's probably going to take 10, 15 years for us to really see these things come into fruition and you know, really flourish. But at that point, when things are going well, you know, exactly, we probably won't be in government in 15 years' time, exactly, just in terms of like how long political parties last. Let's not even talk about this week. But we're not gonna get probably to take that as a win for us. I don't know, maybe the public will remember. I doubt it based on how short-term memories have worked recently. And I think that this is a really bad feedback loop that we have in as a society right now, where we as citizens just think about our own self and not about the broader picture and the long-term goals.
Well, that's why we're in the Labour Party, right? Because we believe in that sense of the collective. We believe in that sense of solidarity, you know, right across society. Irrespective of, you know, where you come from, where you're born, like, we have that sense of cohesion and wanting to do better as a collective, rather than pursuing a sense of, you know, individualism.
Yeah.
You know, we want people to flourish individually, but we have to recognise that we're part of a society, and we have to do right by our fellow citizens.
And I guess with the kind of populist right anti-climate change kind of brigade that's coming in and becoming more popular and scarily more legitimized as they kind of take office around the world. What do you say to those people, people who may be flirting with those kind of ideas, legitimately or illegitimately, whatever? They're people who are sympathetic to what maybe reform and others are saying in this country and have this narrative around the net zero zealotry or whatever. How do you accommodate that again in your own kind of politics?
Well, you have to advocate for the that sort of middle way, and you have to recognise that people are saying things that maybe you don't agree with, but you have to provide them with an alternative. You can't provide them between a binary position of, you know, black and white. It has to be, you know, it's that
shades of grey,
and yeah. And articulating that in a way that people can understand,
yeah.
And not using the word articulate.
We need a vision for society that people can really buy into, you know, and I don't think we've kind of fully figured that out yet. I hope that this week and everything that's happened again offers the government at the top to really think about this message. Like, yeah. We've said a decade of national renewal. We've said, like, you know, we're going to fix foundations and blood, like, that's too wishy-washy. Like, you need something more, like, tangible and robust.
Well, there is tangible targets within that. So in terms of the commitment around building new homes, in terms of the employment rights bill, in terms of the NHS, there are commitments around that rhetoric. And, you know, maybe, you know, yes, the communication of that, maybe that, you know, clearly with the look at where you're looking at the polls, there's a disconnect there between what's happening in practice in terms of the reforms that are being put in place and the actions of government and what people are feeling.
One of the things I'm just always curious by, and I constantly think about this, is what does social democracy look like for the next 70 years? I'm 28. There's a likelihood I've got another 70 years left on this planet if we're to go by statistics. What does this Labour government build to last for the next 70 years? I think about the Attlee government, who were institutions that last to this day. New Labour was a new Labour party for a new century. What is the kind of underpinning story and narrative of this government that we can say in 70 years' time, that's what a Labour government did, outside of rectifying the NHS, outside of building the necessary houses that we need, outside of taking necessary action on climate change? What are the institutions that we're building, and what is the underpinning narrative that hopefully will last a century or longer?
I think that's all the things you just articulated are the reasons why I believe the Labour Party is the perfect party in which to try and build this new Jerusalem.
New social contract.
The new social contract, because ultimately a lot of these institutions that were built up over the 20th century are fraying.
Yeah.
And you can see that on an international level. You can see that on a domestic level. And the Conservative Party inherently wants to conserve things. Mm-hmm. And, like, quite frankly, that's not working for people. And so we need to have a new, as you said, a renewed social contract. You know, a big state is here to stay, because if you look at defence, if you look at what happened with the pandemic, all these things in terms of people relying on the state and needing a dynamic state in order to provide for its citizens in the 21st century. And the party that can do that, the party that's done that before and can do it again, is the Labour Party. And that needs to be articulated, again using that word, very strongly and very clearly to the people of this country.
Yeah, I mean, look, we've all crowded our heads into this room specifically because we understand that, like, how necessary this is, and we know that it's not an easy fight. And I don't know about you guys, sometimes I get a bit, like, feel the weight of the world sometimes, do you know what I mean? That every morning, like, something new happens and we have to completely reassess our dynamics, and it's just like, It's obviously never going to be basic, straightforward and easy. But if we can hold our hands up at the end of it all and say, like, we gave it our best, that we're proud of what we did, like, we know that we made the right decision in that situation, that's enough. Like, come what may, you know, political success wise, come what may, just do the right thing, honest thing, you know?
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. As politicians, right, the measure of success that everyone has is whether or not you win the next election, you hold on to your seat. But that isn't an end in of itself.
Right? No.
You have that's a consequence or a symptom of the actions that you've taken over that period of time that you've been elected. And ultimately, that's the reason why you get into this. Like, you get into this because you want to put forward a new agenda. You want to change people's lives. You want to help people. You're not doing this because you want to be in this endless state of being elected for what purpose, right? There has to be a purpose. There has to be a guiding set of values, of principles that you stick by, because otherwise, what are you and why are you here?
Yeah. Thank you so much for your time, Henry. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, no worries. Thanks very much.
It wasn't easy to get an MP on after the last 24 hours we've had. So we appreciate you taking on the mantle.
No pleasure. Thanks so much.
Henry's obviously got childcare to do now, because at the same time as being an MP, which is, by the way, the most impossible job I've ever seen, he's also become a father. So yeah, big ups, Henry. Congratulations.
Thank you very much.
Send our best to the little one.
I will do. Cheers, guys.
Cheers.
Thank you.
That was a good chat.
Yeah, I know. He's just an interesting guy who I'm surprised by his level of independence. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, he was very honest. I think we probably actually need more MPs like Henry who are willing to think for themselves. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that I kind of got from that was that he'd really thought very deeply about why he was signing that letter. And the impression that I got, not necessarily just from the media, but I guess just from more broadly, like the way the parliamentary Labour Party is like set up and working, is that there were people who were signing that amendment who would just did not care.
Yeah, exactly.
And like weren't thinking things through. Haven't thought about how we get people back into work. And just when, you know, I've got a slim majority and I'm not upset.
That's the thing that I admire about him, was that he was able to draw upon his experience in a previous life as a barrister working for the trade union. He had consulted and spoke to his constituents. He understood the kind of lay of the land of his own constituency. He made his own political judgment in line with his own principles and values, and concluded that he couldn't support the bill as it stood,
yeah,
however many days ago. And I think that's the kind of almost expertise and political judgment that we need to see more from our MPs, and maybe a bit more agility from government. It's just, What are my values, and how does it sit with the people I'm actually there to represent? And where are you putting country, quite literally, before party? I think the debacle over the last couple of days has demonstrated that parties are not immune from making decisions what they perceive to be in their parliamentary or political interests.
Yeah,
and I think it's really refreshing that we have MPs who have a lot more kind of candor, as you say, to make some judgments that are necessary.
Yeah, I think the difficult thing is that I accept his analysis, but how we actually get people into work seems to be like a much deeper...
But it goes to your point about work is actually disempowering for a lot of people. In like an atomized gig economy where you said there's no sense of solidarity, people aren't able to interact with their colleagues, they're not involved in any union or broader kind of work activity. Alongside that, it doesn't pay very well. Housing is expensive. Public services are...
But the only people who do those jobs, mate, are like people who... Immigrants, mate. It's that, like, the only people who come to this country... I had one friend I know who used to work like night shifts doing on the bike, delivering food whilst he was at uni. And he had to. Like, he had to be able to pay for uni. He was like a mature student. But like, there's loads of British people, I think, would just think that that's
beneath
them. They
turn their nose to it.
If it's beneath them. Yeah. That guy was British, by the way. On the one hand, I'm like, you can be conscientious and diligent in that sort of vein and like push yourself really hard when you have to. But he also had like a long-term vision for what his life was doing.
Yeah.
I'm paying for this education in computer science.
There are still very many people who do that work, who have a level of aspiration and ambition. Mm. And the workforce just completely relegates them to just cheap labor, unskilled labor, people who don't have much to contribute into society. And I think once we reshape that whole narrative around work, the future of work, the labor market more broadly, that's how you can get more effective solutions then to welfare and the kind of ballooning issue. We haven't looked at the kind of insecurity and precarity around the labor market, and yet we've tried to solve this issue whilst there are very many people who are in work, receiving benefits. We haven't consulted the right people. We do need to kind of, the Employment Rights Bill is obviously a necessary and welcome addition, but actually looking at the constitution of the labour market, as you understand it, is a huge, huge challenge.
It's important that we do remember that we've done loads around employment rights. You've been in government, stuff that the Tories would have never done. We banned fire, you rehire, we've ended 0-hour contracts. You know, we've done all of this stuff to strengthen workers' rights. And when you go and tell the public about that, they're delighted. Like, you know, that TUC video I showed a while ago, where it's like, you know, people, when they explain to people in simple terms about how their job is now more secure because of the government, people are really happy to hear that. And they're shocked to discover that like Reform voted that down and Nigel Farage voted that down, because obviously those people aren't actually on the side of the workers. But this is part and parcel of the problem, that, you know, we keep on going in circles around this comms issue that the Labour Party has. But it's the comms environment that the Labour Party lives in. Mm-hmm. You know, in our country, when we have an incredibly right-wing press, when you have a social media algorithm that only is satisfied by like short-termist nonsense, bullshit answers, you know, when you're actually trying to explain to people, because it is complicated, like what we actually have done to make things better and to bat for their side, people like that.
Yeah, exactly. But it's much more difficult to get across. I think also the Labour Party is operating in a space that just no longer exists. I mean, press conferences, op-eds, these kind of things.
They're so antiquated.
They're so old fashioned. And I think you have to embrace basically new media. And until Labour, MPs, whatever, it's no surprise Nigel Farage has the largest following on TikTok than any other MP. He's embracing of new technologies. And until the government is just a lot more willing, I think, to embrace that style of communication, it means that they can be a lot more effective in the type of narration that they want to put forward as well, because they know that it has to be short, snappy, interesting, to a point provocative, but also gets the point across. What is the simple message that this government is doing, and how is it benefiting your life? And we all know that because the government's doing brilliant things, but how are people who politics is the last thing that they think about, but may scroll on their phone and see a 20 or 30 second video of XMP, so-and-so, whoever, doing whatever. That is, I think, a failure of political judgment, political comms, at least in the time that we're living in today. Would you not say?
Yeah, I mean, like, that's part of the reason that we do this, right, is because we acknowledge the importance of having your own audience and speaking to people authentically and honestly. I think one of the big compromises is that, like, politics itself forces politicians to be dishonest, like the way in which it's set up. People don't really talk about the trade-offs in, like, clear resolution, you know. The thing I said to Henry about the Tories like lying about like cutting taxes, like that's where some of the rot comes in us as a society, is that we act as if some of the trade-offs that are available and they're just not, like, you know, the Tories would have had, like, Boris Johnson of the IFS, it was pretty clear during the election, he just left now, the IFS. But he was clear at the election that taxes were going to have to be raised by a government, and no one was being honest about spending, really honest. And we fully costed our manifesto at the time, but as we found out, as soon as the day one entering the doors, you know, the coffers are empty and things have been destroyed. And I think this is what's the real root of populism in this country, is the fact that we've just made disastrous political decisions since Iraq.
But also cheap solutions to rather complex problems. I mean, it's quite easy and everyone wants to hear the fact that taxes aren't going to rise, but until the reality suggests that this is what you actually have to do, it's just a cheap, easy way out for votes. Yeah. And I think it's not only dishonest, it's disingenuous. I think it misplaces the kind of collective intelligence of people in our country. I think there's an assumption that, oh, well, we can kind of, to a point, get away with it because circumstances are such that we have to. But people are a lot more kind of graceful, a lot more intelligent, a lot more accommodating of circumstances. If you're straight up with people, you're more likely to get kind of goodwill back from them. And I think until politics more broadly, the operation of politics sees itself less as the be-all and end-all, is willing to allow agency to kind of filter through individuals and communities, but also for it to take a bit of a step back and a facilitator of those things on the economy, on social affairs, on domestic affairs, whatever it may be, then we're in this kind of doom loop, and we're only going to find ourselves more in this cycle of disaffection where people are grieving more about how kind of democracy is coming towards, to a point, maybe its end, or at least as we understand it to be its end. And we're going to flurry in like a horrible, rabid right-wing government, scarily, is what I fear.
I think the obsession with Lee Kuan Yew, which I'm seeing a lot, who's the Singaporean authoritarian, like benign dictator, good dictator. The obsession with him that I just see happening more and more, I think, really...
The banality of it all.
But that explains what's going on, right? Is that people want a leader who will just do this. Who will be effective. Like, and like, That is,
and that's a reasonable thing to want, I would say.
That's why people like Trump in America, is that at least he's shaking the system. And like, we can't be seen to not be doing stuff. And I feel that the problem is that we are, that's like a bit, a kind of understanding people have about the government, is that we don't pass enough, you know, laws, we're not radical enough. And we've just explained loads of things that the government has done that doesn't get talked about. We could also talk about, you know, free school meals for kids, you know, like there are things that we do that just don't get picked up.
But it's also because there's an absence of what do we want, or what do we think Britain should look like by the end of 5 years of a Labour government, yeah, or the end of 5 years of any government. And I think that's where the hardest part for people to kind of imagine comes in, is we're doing all these brilliant things. And I think, I mean, I always think a Labour government's better than a Tory one or any other political party that we have in this country. But the absence of a vision that people can say, you know what, we live in a more equal society. Actually, if people who earn the most in the country are paying their fair share, actually, when I go to the hospital, I can get an appointment on time. Yeah. Oh, my kid can go to a decent state school and go off to do brilliant things. Or even still, even if they don't go on to become the prime minister, they can be a plumber and still afford to live. Or they, if they don't go to university, they can still have dignity in the work that they're pursuing. These are not particularly radical things, but what is radical is a vision. You need a vision, because we're so far from, I think, that type of society we're in now.
Yeah.
And until that is captured and it's authentic and it's articulated in just a way that people can understand and buy into with a kind of hopeful message, the right are just going to do exactly the same thing, but they're going to provide a kind of dystopic, right-wing, radical alternative that if the left concedes any vision, that's where they're headed to.
Well, we need a new social contract. I think that's where my mind keeps taking me. Mm. We need something that it says that if you give in, you get out. Mm. And giving in is not just about for your own self, for your own little island. It's about giving in for the sake of the collective, for the sake of our society. And that is a real radical restructuring since like Thatcher, really, because, you know, she famously said there is no such thing as society. I think we have to make a claim that there is such thing as a society, and we've desecrated it. And that's why things are so bad. And I want people to know that if there were tax rises, that those taxes would be spent properly to make things actually better. And I think if you really framed it in that way, people would buy into it. The problem we've got is a massive level of institutional distrust that even if you did raise taxes, it's just going to be on top of the city.
But also there's a kind of duplicity in all of it, that I'm working really hard and I'm paying the heaviest tax burden in almost 70 years or so, and yet the millionaire billionaire class aren't working as hard as me, and they're not paying the same proportionate level of tax that I'm paying. And there is just that unfairness. And I think that's something that this country is just naturally good at, is a sense of what is right and what is fair. And that whole thing has been completely turned on its head, and people are pissed off. People just can't be bothered for it anymore. And that's the scariest thing, is the apathy and the kind of can't be bothered attitude about it, because you're sleepwalking into something scary, I would say.
We need to get a tax expert on, because there's so much info, like people saying that rich people are taxed loads. It's just you can't see it. And we, you know, we have brought in rules around trying to tax wealth without directly doing a wealth tax. There's a load of information out there that loads of millionaires have left, and then other information saying that not many have left at all. And I think that is what makes it so confusing to kind of like pick out. Like, I didn't even know what is the truth. So we should definitely bring someone on to discuss some of that. This is our emergency episode on, as you can say, still plenty more questions than answers, but we hope you're a little bit more illuminated on what the hell is going on.
Yeah.
What's left? What the hell is left?